Thank you for the invitation to speak here. It's actually a pleasure to visit Canada. When I this morning, actually, on my way over here, I encountered two random men in the street, and both of them were actually able to tell me where the Fields Institute was, which is kind of an interesting commentary on culture. In my hometown, I think the average man on the street would have a hard time locating the University of Arizona, much less a small part of it. Actually, one of them also knew a bit about the history of the construction of this building, so he actually gave me a little bit of a little bit of insight into the history of how it was built. Apparently, it's built on granite, and is one floor higher than it might have been had the original plans actually been feasible. Okay, the topic that I want to discuss today is the short distance behavior of the scaling functions for the two-dimensional easing model. I have the slides are kind of or using transparencies is something that I'm forced to do because I never learned PowerPoint, and so the colorful additions here on the edge are intended to compensate somewhat for the otherwise rather dull-looking slides. But the topic that I want to discuss is actually kind of it's a bit old, actually. It's most of the references that I've put up here are from many years ago, and what I want to do is discuss some applications of work that was done by Sato, Miwa, and Jimbo some time ago from perhaps a slightly different point of view to actually analyze the short distance or scaling behavior of the scaling functions for the two-dimensional easing model. So here I've given some references. I have the uneasy feeling, actually, giving a talk to physicists that many of you probably actually understand the topic that I'm talking about better than I do, in the sense that the easing model is something that many physicists have written papers on. But in particular, I thought that I might actually make reference to a few articles from many years ago, one by Kadnoff and Siva, in which they discussed the operator content and actually multivalued functions for the easing model and disorder operators. McCoy, Wu, Tracy, and Baruch wrote a well-known paper in which they actually show that the two-point functions are for the easing model in the scaling limit are actually given by or expressible in terms of Pan-Levé functions. And then those two developments were actually synthesized and kind of generalized by Sato, Miwa, and Jimbo in a series of papers in 1978 through 80. And that's actually, those papers are the ones that I learned about the subject from. There are a series of papers on what are called holonomic quantum fields. A good description of that is actually in another paper by Kadnoff and Komoto in 1980, about the same time. I had the feeling, and perhaps I could ask him while he's since he's at the conference, that perhaps Professor Kadnoff was not so surprised by Sato, Miwa, and Jimbo's work, whereas for me, anyway, it was quite exotic stuff. At any rate, there's a good summary of their work in a paper in 1980 that, in which virtually all the magic of their development is condensed into some local operator product expansions. Part of what I'm going to discuss is joint work I did with Craig Tracy some years ago in 1981 and 83. The other aspects of what I'm going to be talking about are largely due to a recasting of the Sato, Miwa, Jimbo work that's due to Malgrange and Siegel and Wilson, and to a certain extent Ed Witten in 1988.
The respond to your implied question. Fujito, Komoto, and I were tremendously impressed by the work of Sato, Miwa, and Jimbo. We felt that we understood something at the corner of it. We felt that there was lots more to be understood, and hence we applaud the notion that there is more study of this thing. I think it's very much worth it.
Huh. Thank you. So, in fact, actually, the thing that I want to do is show that there's a formula that's due to Luther and Peschel in 1975, some years ago, in which they looked at what should be the conformal limit for the easing model correlation functions, and determined a formula that turns out to be correct, at least in the case that I'm going to consider here. There's also some further work by Tracy and Whittam that concerns the scaling analysis in the two-point case, which is actually it's more complete than the analysis that I'm going to discuss today for the endpoint correlations. Okay, so let me outline the talk that I want to give is one in which I'm going to focus a fair portion of the talk on the Sato-Miwa-Jimbo analysis of the scaling limit from a slightly, perhaps, different point of view. First, I'll discuss the spin representation for easing correlations, the Dirac-Green function that's sort of the central player in this, the localization of the Dirac operator, and what that has to do with Grassmannians. The representation of the scaling functions as tau functions. In this case, the tau functions that I have in mind are ones that were introduced, they're sort of algebra geometric objects introduced by Siegel and Wilson. I'll write down the mass zero representation for the short distance behavior of the correlations, and then look at the mass zero limit of the Dirac operator, Green's function. That's in outline what I propose to do. And being a mathematician and not a physicist, it's hard for me not to start sort of at the beginning, I guess, probably bore you with some details about, as I say, things that you doubtless have better intuitions about than I do. The two-dimensional easing model, anyway, to begin, is can be described in terms of a Gibbs measure on a finite subset of the two-dimensional lattice. Configurations for such a spin system are maps from the finite subset lambda. There is a pointer here, I guess. Oh, yeah. Now all I have to do is see if I can turn it on. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, configurations are assignments of plus or minus one to each of the points in a finite dimensional lattice, and there's an energy associated with the configuration, which is just given by a sum of the products of nearest neighbors. So the sum actually is over nearest neighbors in lambda with some proviso that I'll say just a word about in a moment, and coefficients, these interaction constants, jij. The model that I'm going to consider is one in which there's translation invariance, so the jijs aren't really allowed to be anything, but it's important, I guess, for the sort of formulas that I'm going to write down that these coefficients have both horizontal and vertical translation invariance. They could be separate, actually. Anyway, there's when these coefficients are positive, and that's the case that I'm interested in, the interaction is ferromagnetic. It tends to favor nearest neighbor aligned spins, and the probability density that's associated with this is the standard one. Namely, there's an exponential of minus the energy divided by the Boltzmann constant times the temperature divided by the partition function here. And the thing that I'm interested in looking at are correlation functions associated perhaps with different boundary conditions here. The two that turn out to be easiest to analyze are plus boundary conditions below the critical temperature and open boundary conditions above. So plus means that on the boundary of the finite subset lambda, I've put all spin up or plus boundary conditions. And the open boundary conditions means that the terms that are included in the energy omit any boundary terms. So none of the spins on the boundary actually occur in that formula. No, well, so it should depend on just the horizontal separation, or there could be separate vertical and horizontal interaction constants, but along any horizontal line that they don't change, and along the vertical lines they don't change either. So there are two basic, they're just two constants, yeah. Yes, nearest, that's right. So these sums, for sure, that, because I'm actually interested in the version of this model that has been exactly solved in some sense, and yeah, the nearest neighbor requirement is, that's what these little brackets are supposed to indicate. Yeah, it should be a nearest neighbor sum. So the correlation functions for this model are the sort of standard probabilistic moments for the spin variables. And there's nothing strange about that, but there is something interesting about the model in that the correlation functions in this case actually depend on the boundary conditions, at least if you're below the critical temperature. So in taking the first limit, okay, which is important, is to take the infinite volume or thermodynamic limit. And here, this limit, I have lambda going to Z2. In fact, actually, the sort of transfer matrix formalism that is used requires that first you go to infinity in one direction and then to infinity in the other. I guess there are theorems about the fact that it doesn't really matter for plus boundary conditions down below the critical temperature, and for any arbitrary boundary conditions above the critical temperature. Anyway, this is an example of a model in which there's a phase transition or a spontaneous symmetry breaking. There's a critical temperature below which the one-point function with plus boundary conditions is actually positive, and above which the plus boundary condition correlations are zero. By changing, so it's called symmetry breaking, but because the sort of formal symmetry in the energy here, namely this is invariant under a spin flip, if I changed all the sigmas to minus sigma, the energy doesn't change. But the boundary conditions are sufficient to actually control the behavior of the correlations below TC. And here, if you were to insist on minus boundary conditions, that would of course make this spontaneous magnetization here negative. Okay, well, the next thing that I want to describe is actually one version of the way in which this model is exactly solvable. And before I can do that, I need to describe something about spin representations for the special orthogonal group of associated with a Hilbert space, W. So here, W is a complex Hilbert space that has a distinguished bilinear form. So the distinguished bilinear form is one that's derived from an inner product. On the right-hand side, these little angular brackets are supposed to mean that I'm looking at a sort of standard Hilbert space. And having a distinguished bilinear form is the same as having a distinguished conjugation. So there's a notion of taking complex conjugates of vectors in this vector space. And associated with a complex bilinear form like this, there is something called the Clifford relations, in which the anti-commutator of two elements, x and y, is given by the inner product, or actually the complex bilinear form, x inner product y, times the identity. So what I'm going to do is describe some representation of the Clifford algebra, which is a kind of standard thing to do, in terms of a polarization for the vector space W. So a polarization is actually a splitting of the vector space W into two pieces, W plus and W minus. These two subspaces are isotropic in the sense that this bilinear form is assumed to actually vanish on both W plus and W minus separately. You can think of W plus as corresponding to the sort of creation operator part of W, and W minus corresponding to the annihilation operators. And the representation of the Clifford relations that realizes that is one that exists on the alternating tensor algebra over W plus. So that looks like a direct sum of the vacuum state, which is just a C here, a multiple of the, or it's a multiple of one if you want, direct sum W plus, and then direct sum the tensor products of W with itself. There, in this case, the alternating tensor products of W with itself. And the sum is an infinite one, and, you know, to make sense of it, you need to look at completions. The standard representation, anyway, of the Clifford relations on these is given by taking x and splitting it into two pieces, x plus and x minus, that are the elements in this subspace decomposition, or the polarization for W, and writing the creation operator associated with x plus and the annihilation operator associated with, not exactly x minus, but the conjugate of x minus. Anyway, those two, this gives a standard representation of the Clifford relations. One reason for describing it in these terms is because the thing that I'm actually interested in talking about, which is the representation of the special orthogonal group, is a little bit easier to understand in terms of the Clifford relations instead of the instead of thinking about things in terms of annihilation and creation operators. So although there isn't much difference between introducing annihilation and creation operators, it's a little bit easier to talk about the special orthogonal group if I discuss it in terms of representations of the Clifford relations.
Could you just give us the way you're going? Are you going now to use the matrix method?
Well, what I'm going to do is actually, once I've finished with describing this sort of standard representation for the special orthogonal group, just describe how it is that you can represent the correlation functions for the easing model as expectations of elements from this group here. Okay, so it's this is just a preliminary to actually writing down the representation of the infinite volume or thermodynamic limit. I should perhaps, yeah, I should have said why it is that I'm doing this. Okay, at any rate, there is a projective representation of the orthogonal group on W. Now, W, so here, W has this inner product, and elements of the orthogonal group are just elements, are transformations of W that preserve this complex bilinear form. So the restricted special orthogonal group is a little bit different in that G is an orthogonal transformation, so it actually preserves the bilinear form here. And it's restricted in the sense that if you write down its matrix relative to this decomposition, B and C will be Schmidt class operators. A and D are just going to be Fredholm. No, in fact, so this is a formal relation in which the generators of some algebra are actually, if you want, indexed by the elements in W. There isn't actually, W is not an algebra in any sense, but it
would be here there is an algebra and the state field correspondence that they say to each vector in the
correspondence. Well, in this case, actually, this is the most elementary version of that in some sense, because it's what happens is that you know this. No, but look down here. If you look at this is what X is supposed to be. It's represented by annihilation and creation operators in the alternating tensor algebra.
And then it's another.
Yes, right. So they. Right. And so this relation is actually, this relation here is satisfied by these operators. Okay, so you're right that I've left you with the impression that you can multiply vectors, but inside the Clifford algebra this is possible, but obviously not inside the vector space. Okay, so the representation of the special orthogonal group that I'm interested in is in terms of what you might think of as a spin group associated with W. It's also, physicists might think of it as Bogle-Yubov transformation, or refer to it as Bogle-Yubov transformations. And these guys, the little g's here in spin, are have the property that they induce automorphisms of the Clifford algebra. That is, if you take g and you transform a generator of the Clifford relations by similarity, then you get a new element of the Clifford algebra, which is given by this operator T of G acting on X. Now, T is actually, this T acts on a dense invariant domain. It doesn't tend, it's not in general going to actually be a bounded operator. the sort of crucial ingredient that will make it possible to write down formulas for the easing model correlations is one that's partly due to Sadamu and Jimbo. And if you have a product of elements in the spin representation with non-vanishing vacuum expectations, so that's what these are here, the vacuum expectation of a product is actually the product of the one-point functions times a certain Fafian. And here, I'm not being too explicit about it, but the Fafian is actually given as the square root of a determinant in which the off-diagonal pieces here are Schmidt class, and the square root is actually a holomorphic function of lambda. So the Fafian is actually determined as a kind of holomorphic square root of the determinant. Okay, so capital G acts on the alternating tensor algebra? Little g. Oh, you mean capital G? Which one? Oh, yeah, little g is, so little g is an element in this group here. It acts on this space here. It acts on the alternating tensor algebra. So the quantized space, if you want. So this is actually, these guys, the little g's are actually... Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a Fock space representation for, a Bogle-Yubov transformation that's acting on Fock space. Okay, and it has the induced rotation, what Sadamu and Jimbo call the induced rotation is this T of G here. Then the T is actually a homomorphism from a group of operators that act on a densely defined subspace here into the restricted special orthogonal group. Okay, so there's an interesting representation for easing correlations given in the following way, namely that so if you take the infinite volume limit for spin correlations with plus boundary conditions, you can write that as a vacuum expectation of a time-ordered product where these guys on the right-hand side, the sigma alphas, are actually elements in the spin group. The spin here has nothing to do with easing spins, but it's just the spin representation of the orthogonal group. But here, each one of these is actually, each one of the spin operators is actually given by a similarity transformation by the transfer matrix, and then a spin operator which represents which is determined, again, in terms of its induced rotation. So down here, let me describe this representation for the correlation functions is actually valid whenever T is not equal to the critical temperature. And the time ordering, it refers to the fact that in this product, I order the second coordinates of the A's so that they're in increasing order from right to left. So the second coordinates of these guys are ordered so that they're increasing from right to left. Okay, so this gives a sort of group theoretical version of what exactly it is that the easing correlations look like in the thermodynamic limit. The induced rotations that actually determine both they determine the transfer matrix, that's what V is here, and also the spin operator are given by the following formulas. So T of V, that's the induced rotation for the transfer matrix, these are 2x2 matrices that I haven't written down, but it's basically a finite difference operator that's acting on the vector space little l2 of, you could think of it as just z, it's not important that it be z plus a half, with values in c2. So the transfer matrix has an induced rotation, which is just a, finite difference operator here, with 2x2 matrix coefficients. This is kind of a standard, this observation is kind of the, is one that was made by Kaufman in one of the earliest papers on the easing model. The induced rotation for the spin operator is pretty simple as well. The delta IK are the sort of standard basis elements for this little L2 space. So they're one at one site, and because it's taking values in C2, there's an extra delta function argument here. So these are just the standard basis elements then for this space, and the induced rotation for the spin operator just looks like this little, a very simple sine function. The sine of the difference between x, which is a point in z, and k, which is in point z plus a half, is just either plus or minus, right, times that, depending on the location. Anyway, the polarization is given by splitting the vector space, this one here, into the positive, the spectral subspaces associated with the transfer matrix, associated with spectrum in the interval from 0 to 1, and the spectrum in the interval from 1 to infinity. This induced rotation turns out to have a gap in the spectrum about 1. So in the neighborhood of 1, if you're away from the critical point, the spectrum actually doesn't get close to 1. And this splitting is unique. So here, it turns out that if you look at the transfer matrix itself, it's 1 on the vacuum component. And then T plus is the restriction to the subspace where it's acting by, it acts by eigenvalues that are actually less than 1. So this thing here is a contraction, as are all the higher order terms. In this version of looking at it, you can see clearly that 1, the vacuum is actually the unique highest, the unique eigenvector associated with the largest eigenvalue for this guy in that case. So there's a simple formula then for T in terms of its induced rotation. So it's possible to prove this formula rigorously, so that it actually makes mathematical sense. And there are some formulas that are due to, well, partly again due to Sato, Miwa, and Jimbo, that allow you to write the expectations in terms of a product of one-point functions here. So the nth power of the one-point function below TC times an infinite Pfaffian, which is a convergent, essentially a convergent determinant. And there's a similar representation above TC, in which case, however, you don't factor out the one-point functions, which are zero, but factor out the one-point functions evaluated at the dual temperature below TC. And here this T, the matrix T is a finite it's actually an n by n matrix, and it doesn't refer to time ordering. It's just a finite dimensional Pfaffian that represents the difference between these two correlation functions. One advantage of this particular representation is that the clustering that you would expect in pure states actually is a consequence of the multiplicative property for determinants. So there's a sort of simple there's a simple way in which if you separate two clusters by some translation A here, and then let the translation go to infinity, the correlation functions factor in that way, and it's a simple consequence of the multiplicative property for determinants. Okay, well, the next limit that I want to look at is the scaling limit for the Ising correlations. So in this case, excuse me, there's something called a correlation length associated with the Ising model correlations. And if you look at the two-point function for the correlations, say, in a plus boundary condition, then and subtract off the square of the spontaneous magnetization, then this difference actually tends to zero as the difference between A and B tends to infinity. And the asymptotics are given by a power function and an exponential here. In the exponential, there's something called a correlation length.
That's supposed to be in the scaling regime.
Well, if you fix the temperature, this is
the direction of the
yes, that's true. Yeah. No, and so this is only a rough Yeah, that's true. So here, the correlation length has the property that it tends to infinity, or if you want the mass term, tends to zero as T goes to the critical temperature here. The scaling regimes that are of interest, I guess, in this model are the Gaussian regime, in which the site separation for the correlations is much greater than the correlation length. The conformal regime, in which the site separation is larger than the lattice spacing, but smaller than the correlation length, or much smaller than the correlation length. And the one that I'm actually going to consider, which is a regime in which the site separation is on the order of the correlation length. So in this third regime, I want to look at scaling functions, and they're given as limits. So the limit, what you do is you look at the correlations on the scale of the correlation length. I take some real numbers, or I should say lattice, no, elements in R2, A1 through AN, and multiply them by the correlation length. Now, in this case, actually, in the model, there are two different, the vertical, there could be two different masses. There could be a sort of vertical mass and a horizontal one, or a vertical correlation length and a horizontal one. And it, you need to scale these appropriately here. No, the critical exponents don't change. No, it's just that in one case, in this case here, these are not going to be homogeneous functions, whereas the scaling limit that I'm going to discuss eventually will refer actually more to the conformal regime in which the correlation length would be homogeneous. These, in this scaling limit, what's happening is there's a sort of dependence on the temperature. If you were to look, for example, at what happens when you fix the temperature at the critical point and look at the large-scale behavior, then you would end up with homogeneous functions for these scaling limits, whereas these are not. Yeah, it is. That's right. And these, the one-point functions down here will actually show that sort of behavior. They will. Oh, up here? Yeah, it turns out that even though you're right, okay, that it would be, you know, that this, the at the critical point, there's a quarter rather than a half, okay? The half still appears when you're away from TC. It's not. Yeah, it's not. Yeah. So anyway, it's. Yeah. Anyway, there are two different critical scaling limits, one from below TC, so the minus refers to that, and one from above, in which the one difference here is, so I've divided out by the one-point functions. These are going to zero, so they amount to sort of an infinite rescaling in the limit. And here, there's also going to be an infinite rescaling, but instead of dividing by the one-point function, which is zero above TC, I divided it by the one-point function at the dual point. Anyway, it's possible then to actually, the Pfaffian formulas that I wrote down before do actually have a scaling limit, and you can write down explicit convergent infinite Pfaffian representations for these two scaling functions. And it's still, it's possibly of interest that in those two formulas, the clustering is still manifest. So let me describe the Sadamuwa-Jimbo analysis of the scaling functions. The Clifford algebra generators scale to free Fermi field. So this is almost universally recognized in the physics literature by something. This phrase actually appears a lot. The Ising model is, of course, a free fermion. And the reason for saying that is just that these generators for the Clifford relations actually turn out to be the solutions to the Dirac equation in the scaling in the limit in which in the scaling limit that I'm interested in looking at. Here, the Dirac operator is the Euclidean Dirac operator, so it looks something like this. It just has the derivatives with respect to the complex variable z, and so dvz and dvz bar make an appearance here in that version. So in the appropriate sort of coordinates, the Clifford algebra actually has a scaling limit which is essentially given as a Euclidean free Fermi field. So one way to understand the SMJ work is to introduce mixed correlation functions here. And the plus or minus refers to either above or below the critical temperature. The mixed correlations that I have in mind look like products of these free fields, psi and psi of x and psi of y, times the spin operators. You take a vacuum expectation, either above or below TC. This is now, I'm talking about scaling functions here, so these are limits. One refers to the subcritical and the other supercritical scaling. The time ordering prescription in this case makes, so this is a time ordered product in which the second coordinates of x, y, and also the a's, a1 through an, are ordered in increasing values from right to left. And because of the time ordering prescription, there's actually a difference in the boundary values between sigma a times psi of x when x2 is bigger than a2 and what happens when psi is to the left. So in a when you have, say, for example, psi of x in a neighborhood of one of the points a, this time ordering prescription introduces a change in the boundary values coming from above and below. And one way to understand what's one way to think about what's going on then is that this turns out to be a Green's function for the Dirac operator, that's this thing here, but it's these boundary values actually suggest that the Green's function is actually the Green's function for a Dirac operator that's acting on sections of a vector bundle rather than well-defined functions on R2. So you can think of this as now being the Green's function for a Dirac operator, but it's acting on sections of a vector bundle that live over the complex plane minus the sites A1 through AN. Now, it's also possible to actually show that with the use of something like a local operator product expansion for this time-ordered product, that the Green's function is going to, this particular Green's function that's obtained here, is going to have a local expansion in the x variables that looks something like this. The coefficients here, the c's, are actually operators, but the w's are solutions to the Dirac equation, which are simultaneously eigenfunctions for the infinitesimal rotation operator that commutes with this Dirac operator. So they look like Bessel functions times exponentials in the theta variable. And as I say, the local operator product expansion for this actually shows this Green's function should have a form that looks like I said these were operators. That's not true. What is true is that they're functions of y and a. So c, I, n actually depends on y and a in this expansion. Anyway, this turns out to be sort of just a classical Green's function for a Dirac operator that's acting on the sections of some vector bundle. And the expansion coefficients are circumscribed. That is, in principle, that sum would actually be a sum from n equals minus infinity to infinity. Here, the sum starts at zero, and in fact, the zeroth order coefficients are the thing that determine which of the two Green's functions you're looking at. Whether you look at the Green's function with the minus sign or with a plus sign. So with the minus sign here, the two zeroth order coefficients are the same. With a plus sign, that is above TC, the two differ by a sign. So in this case, the Green's functions that are associated with this are distinguishing the what happens above and below TC. Okay, so what I want to describe next is actually a sort of lead up to how it is that you can actually reformulate the what it is that the scaling functions actually are in the case of the easing model. And it has to do with localizing this Dirac operator away from the singularities in its domain, that is, at the AJs. So if you choose a base point in CN and disjoint disks about those, then let the C be the circle that surrounds those disks. The domain, okay, F, is actually going to be in the domain of this twisted Dirac operator, provided that when you restrict it to a circle, you end up in a subspace. The subspace consists of boundary values of solutions to the Dirac equation in the disk. So here, here's a sort of picture. What I'm going to do is actually look at subspaces which are associated with boundary values of solutions to the Dirac equation in each of these disks. And the solutions are actually not single-valued, but they're multi-valued. And the behavior at this critical point is actually determined by restrictions on the sort of Fourier expansion for the solution at those points. And the diagram is actually has to do with something a little different. It turns out that you can take the same Dirac operator and you could localize it not in the complement of a disk like this, but you could also localize it in the complement of a strip. And the connection between doing it in the strip and doing it in the disk is kind of, in this case, the strip is actually quite natural in making the relation with the transfer matrix formalism in which things are moving up and down. Using the transfer matrix. Notice that the branch cut for the solutions actually then never hits the boundary in that case. Or if you look at the localization in a disk, it turns out that that has a much simpler description in a lot of ways in terms of those radial eigenfunctions. And the relationship between the two is easiest to understand in terms of subspaces, actually. The subspace boundary conditions here and the ones that are appropriate for the disk are related to one another in a fairly simple way.
So you're saying that you're looking at the solution of the Dirac equation outside the disk, but you're restricting it to have boundary values, which are the boundary values of the other solution inside the disk, which are boundary values.
Yes,
yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, and in particular, in the case of the strips, the solution outside the disk is actually a single-valued solution to the Dirac operator equation, and the solutions here will be single-valued as well, but inside there's this branch cut, or if you want, you can think of it in terms of vector bundles, either one. Either one is actually okay. So you end up with these subspaces, which actually behave fairly well. The reason that what's nice, I think, in this version of trying to understand what's going on is if you actually push the description to what's happening at the critical point, point A, you run into the usual difficulties with operators not making sense because there's sort of been some infinite renormalization that takes place. But here, the subspace description of what's going on is quite regular. These are actually, once you move away from the singularity at A, these are actually well-behaved subspaces, and it's easier to understand what's going on with them than it is what's going on in a neighborhood of A. Okay, so what I'm getting at is actually a description, finally, of the scaling functions for the easing model as tau functions that are associated with a Grassmannian that's related to a Grassmannian that's defined by Siegel and Wilson, and a certain determinant bundle that lives over this Grassmannian. So the boundary conditions that I'm interested in are these ones in which, so they're associated with subspaces, W sub int plus or minus, which are elements in a Grassmannian of subspaces for it's actually the Sobolev space of order a half that I have in mind. So it's a direct sum of the Sobolev space is associated with the circles that surround the points AJ. And the subspaces are going to, I'm going to assume, are close, or they are actually close to the subspace with this distinguished point A0, so a reference point here. Siegel and Wilson actually showed that it's possible to take the Grassmannian, which is a kind of infinite dimensional algebraic variety, and define a line bundle over it. And that line bundle is going to be the sort of ingredient in attempting to describe the scaling functions for the easing model. So over the portion of the line bundle that sits over these subspaces, there's a determinant bundle. And I'm going to describe trivializations of that determinant bundle in terms of projections onto these subspaces. So it turns out that in describing the scaling functions, you can actually write down formulas for them. So here, so the trivializations of the line bundle that turn out to be important are associated with two different projections. One projection is actually a projection that comes from the Green's function that I defined earlier. It's possible to actually make good mathematical sense out of the Green's function that has... This is a Green's function for the Dirac operator on a vector bundle, right? And there's a formula for the projection onto the subspace boundary conditions that's more or less directly written in terms of the Green's function. This is actually a sort of version of something that's completely familiar in terms of the Cauchy-Riemann operator. So the kernel for the Cauchy-Riemann operator, or the Green's function, is 1 over x minus y, and that's also the kernel of the projection onto the functions that are holomorphic in the unit disk. This formula here is just a version of that for the massive Dirac operator. The other projection that turns out to be important is the direct sum of the projections onto the one-point subspaces. The difference between these two projections is actually the complementary projection. The subspace on which they project is exactly the same, but the complementary projection is different. This one, the complementary projection, is actually the solutions to the Dirac equation in the exterior of the, or boundary values of solutions to the Dirac equation in the exterior of the union of those disks. And this one has a projection which is more complicated. It's actually, the subspace isn't easy to describe. It sort of overlays it's a projection that looks like that for each one of the single points, but not when you put them all together. Okay, so the punchline, I guess, here is this, that if you define the tau function that's associated with these subspaces as a ratio of what's called the canonical section for this bundle, that's the one associated with this projection, and the trivialization that's associated with the sum of the one-point functions like this, that tau function actually turns out to be a determinant, which you can write as the determinant of what happens when you compare two projections. And... Yeah, that's right. So this Grassmannian depends on a base point, which is some fixed choice of an A. And these subspaces, if A doesn't wander too far from A0, the subspaces are actually in this Grassmannian. And so there is this determinant bundle. And the comparison of two different sections gives you a tau function down here, which depends on A, and it also depends on the choice of the subspaces, the plus or minus choice. And you can also write down an explicit formula in terms of determinants. Now, the only reason for being interested in this is this slide, namely that the tau function actually turns out to be, these are the scaling functions for the easing model. And it turns out that the tau function that I've defined is actually the square of the ratio of the tau function at A to what it is at A0. The square comes about because I'm looking at a determinant bundle. There is actually a related Pfaffian bundle, which is more complicated to describe, but that would actually get rid of the square. And so for both So for both the scaling functions above TC and below TC, there is this description of the scaling functions in terms of tau functions for this Dirac operator. And from this point of view, it actually turns out to be quite trivial to see why it is that the derivative of the scaling, or the log derivative of the scaling function, which looks then like this, has a can be written in terms of there's a trace formula in terms of these projections that looks something like that. And the Sato-Miwa-Jimbo theory is basically comes down to this, that the derivative of the projection is related to the derivative of the Green's function, and the derivative of the Green's function turns out to be a finite rank operator. So for this particular vector bundle, and in fact, actually, this is sort of a general feature of a lot of completely integrable models, that is, you can describe them in terms of they turn out to be related to, say, Green's functions for the Cauchy-Riemann operator, but with boundary conditions that make the derivative actually finite rank. That's true for monodromy preserving deformations and also for many other integrable models. In this case, though, anyway, so this is sort of the formula that's the reason the SMJ theory, from this point of view, it's the reason why the SMJ theory works. The derivative of the Green's function with respect to the branch points here turns out to be finite rank, and the function that appears here, this W, is a solution to the Dirac equation, and it's a multi-valued solution to the Dirac equation, and it's uniquely specified by its the behavior of its coefficients in the local expansion about AI. So from this, there's a formula due to Sato-Miwa and Jimbo, which can be written this way. So essentially, by doing a residue calculation here, you can immediately deduce that the derivative of the tau function is given by the level one Fourier coefficients, basically, of this W. So this actually allows you then to describe the correlation functions completely in terms of these level one Fourier coefficients. Now, one reason why it's interesting for the particular thing that I'm doing is what I want to do is actually look at the behavior of the tau function when I introduce a parameter m here that goes to zero. This is going to be the short distance scaling behavior for the scaling functions for the Ising model. So now I'm looking at the scaling functions, which are in the continuum, but I'm going to look at those at short distances, which means I want to actually let m go to zero. And there's a representation for the logarithmic derivative of the tau function with a multiplier m in here that looks like this, with the one difference being that these coefficients are now the zeroth order, or first level one Fourier coefficients for the solution to the Dirac equation with a mass term m. And so to study that limit, I'm going to look at the mass zero limit for the Dirac operator. So here's a reprise of that last slide. The functions capital W are solutions to the Dirac equation. The logarithmic derivative of the tau function is actually, or scaling function, is actually given in terms of the level one Fourier coefficients. And the W is actually determined by some boundary conditions. It has the zeroth order or zeroth level coefficients have the property that they are, the difference is actually delta ij, so it's inhomogeneous. What I'm going to do is simply convert this inhomogeneous boundary condition to, or it's a homogeneous equation with an inhomogeneous boundary condition. There's a sort of standard thing to do to convert this to a, one of these two should be I, so it should be, this should be I, and that should be I. So it's the coefficient about the I point, yeah, right. So I just convert, all I'm going to do is simply convert the description of capital W into the solution of a boundary value problem with homogeneous boundary conditions here and an inhomogeneous right-hand side. And you can do that by subtracting off a sort of known function, a function that has the right behavior at one of the points. Is enough to get rid of it. And phi localizes it to, say, the to AJ, the jth point here. So you can convert the description of this function here to the solution to a homogeneous boundary value problem, in which case the functions that you're looking at now have satisfied the right sort of subspace boundary conditions here. The thing that I'm interested in this formula is the zeroth Fourier coefficient, which looks something like this. Sorry, the level one Fourier coefficient, which looks something like this. And so the idea is to control the m goes to zero limit of this function well enough so that I can actually take a limit in that equation, right, up there. Now, the thing that makes it fairly, it makes it somewhat simple to do is that the subspaces, as I say, are very easy to analyze. And so in the mass zero limit for the subspace boundary conditions turns out to give you the limiting behavior of these subspaces turns out to be something that's very simple. Here, these are sort of standard kind of holomorphic inside and holomorphic outside boundary conditions, except at level zero where one of them has to match the other. The two coefficients have to be the same. That's below TC. Above TC, the same thing is true, except there's a minus sign for one of these guys here. All right, so in the limit, anyway, it turns out to be quite simple to see what happens to the subspaces. Oh, this is actually what, I didn't get this quite right. This is the subspace at infinity, though. Let me just put a picture up. So here, the problem that I want to analyze is the behavior of solutions to this equation where there's an inhomogeneous right-hand term. The inhomogeneous function is supported in this domain. The domain is between an outside boundary circle of radius capital R, perhaps, and small circles that actually surround the points with given subspace boundary conditions here for the solution. F was actually obtained by switching the homogeneous equation with inhomogeneous boundary value for a inhomogeneous equation with a homogeneous boundary value, and it has a little cutoff function that actually makes it zero near the boundary, or near these boundaries here, and it's actually given as a sort of explicit function in a neighborhood of one of the points. It is actually explicitly known, though. You know, it's a subtraction of something that you know the behavior of near this one point, and you cut it off so you don't need to worry about it elsewhere. Okay, well, I'd better finish up. So the fact that the boundary conditions are explicit makes it possible to figure out what the n equals zero Green's function for this guy looks like. And at least for me, this was a bit of a surprise. The Green's function in the limit m equals zero for this operator actually has some terms on the diagonal. So it's, I guess, there's chiral symmetry breaking here. You know, this operator has a certain symmetry that's not actually respected by the Green's function. There's sort of some non-zero terms on the diagonal. So there's a finite rank piece that's on the diagonal. This is sort of a standard, the little g is sort of a standard Green's function for the Cauchy-Riemann operator, or for one of them is for the Cauchy-Riemann operator, that's this one, and the other one is for the inverse of the D operator. But they look like this. The principal part of the kernel looks like this, and there's some multipliers that introduce multi-valued behavior for this Green's function. Anyway, this is what the Green's function can actually be figured out explicitly. It's not, it looks complicated, but in fact, actually the principal reason for making a guess of this sort is precisely to match up the boundary conditions. And the reason it works, I guess, is these guys, this turns out to be, U turns out to be a holomorphic function. So when you hit it with, say, D, for example, it's zero, right? Okay, so so the boundary conditions at infinity turn out to be satisfied because of a homogeneous function identity. And the calculation of the Green, whoops, wrong one. Let me finish by just saying where this finally goes to. And that is that you can actually analyze this in the limit as w goes to zero. The function which we need to, whose Fourier coefficient we need to understand, can be written as a sum of three functions. One of them, the first one, is sort of the most important one. This is just a version of solving the Dirac equation, but with boundary conditions that are in the mass zero limit rather than the full boundary conditions. So here you solve the Dirac equation, but in a subspace that's not quite right. Then the two other terms here, one straightens out the boundary conditions at the expense of adding an inhomogeneous term that's small, and then the third one fixes the extra inhomogeneous term again with the correct boundary conditions. Now this last one I don't have very good control over, but because the correction here was already small with m, I can show that they go to zero. So what happens is, anyway, that this first more or less explicit term, which involves, if you look at it, just the it involves just the mass zero Green's function in the limit as m goes to zero, this term can be shown to go to the identity. So here you end up with just a calculation that involves the mass zero Green's function, and you get the Luther, the asymptotics, which are due to originally to Luther and Peschel. In the limit as m goes to zero, you end up with this sum of homogeneous products, ai minus aj to epsilon ij. That's when n is even. And when n is odd, the limit turns out to be very similar to this. So the sum is over multi-indices. The epsilons can take the value plus or minus a half here. But they have to, this means that they have to sum to zero. And down here, the sum of the coefficients would be either plus or minus one. So they're as close to zero as they can get in this formula down here for n odd. The result, this result here also is true for the short distance behavior of mass zero limit of the scaling functions above TC as well. So you actually get, it's possible to analyze the Green's function in that case as well, although I didn't write it down on these slides. So anyway, the upshot is just that there is actually a mathematical proof then of the convergence of the short distance scaling limit for these scaling functions for the Ising model to the Luther-Peschel formula here, and a sort of modified Luther-Peschel formula there. Thank you.